Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Hey, penny for your thoughts. Or better yet, how about a Japanese yen? Because today, it's worth more. Currency and the global economy on the program from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Sustainability reporting is supported by Johnson Controls, making homes, cars, and workplaces more comfortable, safe, and sustainable. Johnson Controls, where ingenuity is welcome.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Monday. It's the 27th of October. Another day, another dollar in the spreading fallout of the global financial crisis. And we will talk currency today and its role in the state of economic play. This is also the week that bailout money finally begins to circulate into the U.S. economy. We will look at who wants some and the odds they're going to get it. Any discussion of the international currency markets inevitably leads to something known as the carry trade. Sounds complicated, and it can be. But if you think of it this way, it's not quite so painful. You borrow a currency on which interest rates are low, say the Japanese yen. Then you invest where rates are high, or higher anyway, since rates in Japan have been low for years now. And then you pocket the difference. Works real well in normal economic times, but not so good when things go wrong, like, say, right now. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon takes it from there.
There's a reason investors suddenly have a yen for yen, as Axel Merck of the Merck Funds explains it. Investment funds and businesses who've been living on borrowed money now have to pay the piper.
People were borrowing massive amounts of money in Japan, where interest rates are very low, to buy higher-yielding, riskier assets. And right now, those trades are being unwound, and they have been unwound for many, many weeks now, and it will only stop when the selling stops.
Much of that borrowed yen went to emerging economies where it was invested on the promise of higher returns. Now, in the rush to raise cash, it's being converted back into yen, and David Gilmore of Foreign Exchange Analytics says the losing countries are watching helplessly as their currencies implode.
It stretches all the way to places like Mexico, Brazil, and Hungary, and the Ukraine. Europe, Canada, it's sort of across the planet.
Having a more expensive currency isn't good news for Japan either. Businesses there depend on cheaper exports. And now that cash is king, specifically having cash safely in hand, investment strategist Axel Merck says there's less of it being spent where it's needed, on economic growth.
That impedes trades, that people are just paring down their investments, and that's happening on a global scale. And we've seen it in the equity markets, we've seen it with the lack of access to credits, and now the currency markets are emphasizing that and making things worse for everybody.
Merck says it's just another symptom of the world's economic ill health. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The bailout package, of course, is all in American dollars, $700 billion worth, as we know. The news today is that a number of smaller regional banks have signed up for federal cash. Also, that the big names that were strong-armed into taking their share a couple of weeks ago are finally getting their money just now. To chat about the bailout and who's lining up to get their share, we've called economist Doug Elmendorf at the Brookings Institution. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
Here we are 3 weeks after the bailout was signed into law, and just this week we're getting the first injection of cash into these banks. How do you feel about that?
I think the credit situation has improved a little bit and hopefully will improve much more when the money starts to flow. But that still leaves us with very large financial and economic problems.
Well, give me the top three then.
Number one, banks aren't lending to households and businesses that need money and are used to being able to borrow. And that contraction in lending is leading to number two, recession. We are going to see declines in output and incomes and increases in unemployment. Number three problem is rising mortgage foreclosures that are in some ways at the heart of the financial problem, but will require attention directed at foreclosures themselves.
It's not just banks, of course, that are trying to get some of this money or actually getting their hands on it. Car makers want some. Insurance companies want some. Should we be spreading this bailout money out?
It's certainly appropriate to help financial institutions besides banks. Turns out that insurance companies are doing a lot of complicated financial engineering. They're facing the same problems and should be treated the same way. Car companies or other non-financial companies It's more complicated. We need to be sure that we're not just prolonging their underlying problems, but are giving them an incentive and the resources to be more profitable over time.
You can sort of see the bailout making sense for insurance companies and car companies who actually have products that they need to get out into the economy and sell. I'm wondering, though, about banks. We're going to give them this money, get stock in return. Can we make them spend that money in the credit markets?
We do want them to lend. That is the ultimate goal of all of this. It's difficult to force them to do the lending, however. That's a problem. We can encourage it, but we don't want to be in the business of making every individual decision for a bank about who should get money and who shouldn't. I think our best hope now is to inject the capital, give them a stronger base from which they can do more lending.
Whatever happened to Plan A, the plan to buy up all those toxic assets? It seems that sort of got lost in the shuffle of, oh my goodness, we have to inject this money into banks directly.
Yes, most outside observers thought that it was a mistake to focus on buying troubled assets, that it actually made more sense to make equity injections into financial institutions. And I think that as the Treasury thought harder about using the money, they came to the same conclusion. I think that's very good news. I think the money is being better used now. They may still need to go back and buy some troubled assets, but the first problem really is the banks not having enough capital.
Can this bailout make the recession any shorter, the bailout itself, with all the problems in the underlying economy?
Oh, yes. I think the bailout will make a real difference in how long and deep the recession is. I think further action to reduce mortgage foreclosures, further action to stimulate the economy through more targeted government spending and lower taxes can all help to make the recession much less severe than otherwise.
How are we going to know when enough's enough?
Well, the art of economic forecasting has not looked any better over the last year than it has over all the other years. But I think we just need to keep watching. And until we're sure that borrowing is continuing and that spending is continuing, we'll need to keep doing more.
Douglas Elmendorf, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Mr. Elmendorf, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you for having me.
There is something like 3 months left in the Bush administration, plenty of time to move the levers of power. And a spokesman for the Environmental Protection Agency confirmed today that the agency is going to do just that. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner explains.
Aging power plants that want to upgrade and run more efficiently have to pass a pollution test first. If their dirty emissions exceed a certain yearly output, the plant has to install expensive pollution controls. Under the EPA's rule change, those emissions would be judged on an hourly basis instead. Critics say this effectively allows those pepped-up plants that can now run more hours to keep doing business as usual. John Walk is with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
So in the real world, harmful pollution from power plants goes up. The Bush administration pretends like the pollution is not going up on paper, and therefore power plants don't have to install controls to protect the public.
Defenders of the rule change say the current law triggers time-consuming reviews for relatively minor plant upgrades. They also point to another EPA rule that helps keep overall emissions in check. But a federal appeals court this summer unexpectedly rejected the so-called Clean Air Interstate rule. Dan Redinger speaks for the electric power industry.
We've cut pollution in about half since 1980, and there's absolutely no question, you know, something will replace the Clean Air Interstate rule. And then obviously we're looking at greenhouse gas regulation just around the corner.
Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer, who's tussled with the EPA over other issues, has threatened to investigate the agency if it finalizes the new rule. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
There's another story out of Washington today that's getting headlines. Alaska Republican Senator Ted Stevens has been convicted on all 7 corruption counts against him. The senator had been on trial for receiving gifts that went unreported on his disclosure forms. Stevens didn't have anything to say when he left the courthouse this afternoon. On Wall Street today, traders said plenty, sell mostly at the closing bell. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Nope, it's not just you. Not only are planes getting more crowded as airlines cut flights to try to keep from losing too much money, but those overhead bins are more crammed now, too. Kind of makes economic sense if you think about it. Most U.S. airlines are charging to check bags, so suddenly everybody's buying their liquids once they get through security and packing everything else they can into a carry-on. which, of course, don't you know, has led to airlines getting stricter about the size of those bags. From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Airlines are enforcing some packing rules to make sure their cabins don't end up overstuffed. Joe Brancatelli runs business travelers' website joesentme.com. He says, you know the staff that checks your ticket or boarding pass as you wait in line?
Well, those people are now being asked to police the size of carry-ons.
He's been on flights recently where the overhead bins were bursting with bags and the airline ended up checking some of those carry-ons for free. Passengers' increasing desire to travel light has been a boon for luggage salesmen like Harry Seaver of Lexington Luggage in Manhattan.
And the bags fold completely flat like a pancake, and you can expand it, and it meets the exact 45 inches length, width, and height.
He says he's been doing a thriving trade in smaller bags lately.
Everybody wants carry-ons. 75% of the people now only want carry-ons.
Even those arriving in the U.S. from afar, like lawyer Joanne Rennick.
I traveled from Australia with carry-on.
That kind of determination to avoid checking baggage could make Thanksgiving an interesting test for airlines, says Joe Brancatelli. But he says on regular flights these days, there's little need for excessive carry-on vigilance.
There just aren't enough passengers on many flights to worry about it anymore.
He says in the last 3 months, the number of people flying has fallen significantly. And without full cabins, hulking bags aren't such a big issue. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Oil traders looked OPEC right in the eye today and just laughed. Crude fell another 93 cents in New York, down under $64 a barrel, even after the production cuts that OPEC announced on Friday. Obviously, the cartel is worried about the economic effect of tumbling prices, but the collapse of crude could have political fallout, too, especially in countries like Russia, which is as dependent on oil as OPEC. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Here's one rather curious feature of the global financial crisis. On one level, the Russian government seems to enjoy it.
There's clearly some pleasure in Moscow, or has been until today, that it's the American economy that's the cause of all the problems and the American economy is suffering.
Professor Julian Cooper of Birmingham University says Prime Minister Putin and President Medvedev have shamelessly exploited the crisis.
They, rather cleverly, have blamed all the problems of the Russian economy today on the outside world, as if nothing is wrong at all within Russia, which is far from being the truth.
While foreign cash has been flooding into the safe haven of the US dollar, it's been pouring out of the ruble. Capital is fleeing Russia at the rate of $16 billion a week. Bill Browder ran a fund in Moscow for nearly 10 years and was booted out for criticizing the Kremlin. He says a key factor in this massive loss of international confidence is the falling price of oil.
I think that the price of oil is basically all they've got going for them in Russia. They haven't diversified the economy. And so if oil is one half of what it was 6 months ago, then they're one half as wealthy and one half as powerful as they were 6 months ago.
This could have big political repercussions. Many analysts see a direct link between the price of oil and Russia's more bellicose behavior on the world stage. Ariel Cohen is with the Heritage Foundation in Washington. He says that if oil bounces back, Moscow may up the ante.
If oil goes back to 100, then Vladimir Putin has enough cash for new ships, ballistic missiles, and other toys.
But if the global recession takes hold and oil sinks beneath $60 a barrel?
Russia may review its foreign policy priorities.
But don't expect Russia to be any less assertive in its dealings with the West. The sinking price of its principal asset is a problem. But Russia's old adversary has quite a bit on its plate too, says Nick Redman of the Economist Intelligence Unit.
The US is pretty distracted right now. The Bush administration is basically a lame duck administration in Russian eyes. So in that sense, I wouldn't expect to see the Russians caving in on anything anytime soon.
Redman says the Kremlin is sitting pretty on a couple of well-stuffed cushions, foreign currency reserves of more than half $1 trillion, and a sovereign wealth fund of more than $200 billion.
Given that Russia has these absolutely enormous foreign currency reserves, you wouldn't think that the leadership is sweating quite yet.
However, it could be sweating soon. The capital flight continues despite an $80 billion intervention to prop up the ruble. Ariel Cohen says, however it copes with the crisis, Russia should not be ignored.
You can never stop worrying about Russia. Russia too strong or too weak is always a challenge for the West.
What happens next in Russia, says Cohen, depends on the price of oil. And that depends on the length of the global recession. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This next item starts with a question. By the end of it, you'll hopefully be on the way to your own answer. What are you doing? You, as in you, and everybody else out there who's trying to decide right now whether to change the way they manage their money. We're going to be asking that question of listeners and experts on this and the other Marketplace programs. And today we check in with somebody who thinks about the economy for a living.
I'm Simon Johnson. I'm a professor at MIT Sloan. I'm a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, and I run a website with educational, hopefully, materials about the crisis and how we get out of it. I heard a very interesting comment from another commentator, and he said that he'd learned as a young man from a mentor the following, you know, in a crisis, don't just do something, stand there. So that's what I've been doing. I've been standing pat on all my investments. I've worked on financial crises around the world, and I never thought that the US would be in a situation where that kind of experience was not only relevant, but sort of front and center of the debate. So I've been trying very hard to bring that to bear in hopefully a constructive, positive manner. And, you know, it takes somewhere between 18 and 20 hours a day. It has taken that since the middle of September. So I hope I can get a bit more sleep this week. And I'm afraid I get so little sleep during these crises that when I do sleep, I'm not distracted, I don't have any bad dreams, I sleep for as long as I can. I actually went to our local toy store with my two daughters and bought something that they didn't really need, but I wanted to support the store because we love the store and we don't want it to go out of business. And I think it's very important that nobody say, oh, I'm not going to purchase anything for 3 months and see what happens. I think you have to remain calm and you have to go about your lives and you have to persuade people with political power to do the right thing.
Simon Johnson teaches economics at MIT's Sloan School of Management. We have a link to his blog at our website. It's marketplace.org. And while you're there, tell us what you're doing. Coming up, pop culture makes its way into the Bible.
There's Coca-Cola, photos of soldiers helping poor foreign children, Gandhi. Oh! Can't have a Bible without Bono.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials ended the day down 2.4%, about 203 points to close at 8,175. The Nasdaq lost 2.9%, 46 points, finished at 1,505. The S&P 500 slipped 3.1%, 27 points, ended the day at 848. New home sales figures that were better than expected failed to brace up building company shares. Lennar unloaded 1.2%. Centex dropped 1.9%. Retailers connected to the home building industry, though, did better. Home Depot rang up a 2% gain. Verizon got investors' attention after it posted a 31% profit. Can you hear me now? The telecom company shares rose 10%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.68%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about business at Gather.com. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. Missed anything from our special coverage of the fallout from America's financial crisis? You can listen to the entire show or get our After the Bell podcast, a weekly download of the business stories you need to know. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Tuesday. The Federal Open Market Committee begins its two-day meeting on interest rates. The Food Research and Action Center releases a report on the availability of food stamps in urban areas. And the NBA begins its 63rd regular season. This is the first season since 1966 with no Seattle franchise. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Both John McCain and Barack Obama were hustling for votes in Ohio today, just 8 days before Election Day. The two of them are getting most of the attention, of course, but a third of the Senate and all 435 seats in the House are up for grabs, too. Even though congressional approval ratings are at rock bottom, incumbents are enjoying their usual advantage, a massive, massive edge in cash. According to a study from the nonprofit campaign watchdog MapLight.org, over the past 3 years, House members have raised more than $700 million for their reelection campaigns, $500 million of it from people who can't even vote for them. From Washington, Marketplace's Steve Henn explains.
The typical congressman raises almost 80% of his campaign money from people who live outside his district, according to Dan Newman at MapLight.
Politicians will tell you that they represent you, but if the money that fuels their campaign comes overwhelmingly from elsewhere, that raises real Democratic questions about who's really running the show.
James Thurber is a campaign finance expert at American University. He's been tracking political giving for years.
If members follow the money in terms of talking to people or even voting in a particular way, that really undermines what the constituents want in their district.
Members who represent low-income districts say they have to raise money from outsiders to survive. And no one's surprised that powerful members who sit on key committees raise money this way.
Money goes to people who have power.
But Thurber was surprised so much outside money flowed to even junior lawmakers. In fact, just 13 House members raised more than half their cash from their own constituents. MapLight's Dan Newman says special interests spread their money around to cover their bases. Outside donors gave Democrat John Tanner 99% of all his campaign cash.
I'm reluctant to ask my friends at home to give me money when I have money in the bank.
Back home in Tanner's rural western Tennessee district, that doesn't sit well. Rob Vandiver is a constituent.
How can a congressman say with a straight face that he represents the people in his district when only a fraction of a percentage of his money comes from within that district?
But Tanner says his constituents come first. Still,
in this town, you have to raise money to participate in the system. I don't like the system, but that's the system that we deal with.
The town Tanner's referring to is Washington. And in 3 years, more than $200 million in donations to congressional campaigns came from inside its beltway. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
For more on that MapLight study that Steve was talking about, go to our website. It's marketplace.org. Here's a news flash from the publishing industry that isn't in and of itself news. A new Bible is going to go on sale tomorrow. As I said, no surprise, the Bible is, after all, the best-selling book in the world. Half a billion copies are sold every year, and there have been countless versions. But at a time when prayer might well be the only safe investing strategy, there's a twist. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith explains it's all about getting the good book into the hands of an edgier kind of consumer.
You could call it the greatest marketing story ever told.
This looks like an issue of Vogue. There's Coca-Cola, photos of soldiers helping poor foreign children, Gandhi. Oh, can't have a Bible without Bono.
Marketing expert Marissa Gluck from Radar Research is flipping through a copy of the book from Bible Illuminated. It's the New Testament, and it does look like Vogue. The glossy cover features an artsy picture of an eye, and the magazine is packed with striking full-color photos. Post-Katrina New Orleans in Revelations, Andy Warhol in drag for the Book of John. Illuminated World's Larry Norton is in charge of marketing the book. He says Americans buy more than 20 million Bibles every year. But there's a big group of people who aren't in that market.
Smart, educated, urban influencers, young, who
know in their heart of hearts that they should probably have read the Bible but never have.
In other words, the iPod-toting, compulsive text messaging Facebook crowd. Bible Illuminated is launching a $500,000 PR campaign to appeal to them through non-traditional means, like a social networking site and magazine ads. And it's even gotten attention from some modern-day prophets, like Conan O'Brien.
A publisher is coming out with a modern version of the Bible, where many of the most recognizable biblical characters have been replaced by celebrities like Angelina Jolie. Yeah. Yeah.
The book's publisher is former ad exec Dag Soderberg. He says Bible Illuminated is also getting creative about distribution.
Places where you don't find a Bible otherwise. Hair salons, retail fashion stores, trend hotels, and in design stores.
But will hipsters really be willing to drop $35 on the New Testament at their local newsstand? A typical King James Bible goes for less than $10. Again, Radar Research's Marissa Gluck.
From a marketing perspective, I think it's probably a very smart endeavor. You know, this is the Bible wrapped up as Us Weekly.
In fact, the whole Bible market is getting trendy, says Wayne Hastings with publisher Thomas Nelson.
It's moving to a customer who just is asking, how do I get into this book? And oh, by the way, I want it my way.
Hastings says Thomas Nelson has had a lot of success with its edgier Bibles. A magazine format they released last year has sold more than 1 million copies.
We have a lot of letters from customers, for example, young teen girls who said, you know, this looks just like other magazines and I feel comfortable carrying it.
Last year, Thomas Nelson released a slick audio version of the New Testament. The Word of Promise features more than 200 actors and an original score.
Starring Jim Caviezel as Jesus.
Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth.
And Stacy Keach as Paul.
The CD has sold more than 500,000 copies. A division of HarperCollins released a green Bible earlier this month using soy-based ink and recycled paper. It's already in its second printing. And Doubleday recently released a manga Bible with a trash-talking samurai-style Jesus. With Americans spending more than $800 million a year on religious books, publishers are trying anything they can to rewrite the book on Bible sales. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $8 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, and nothing against heavy metal music and all, but have you considered the possibility that AC/DC is responsible for the global economic slowdown? London's Guardian newspaper did and came up with some very interesting parallels over the weekend. The band was formed in 1973 in Australia. Oil embargo, anybody? 1980, their breakthrough album Back in Black is released right as a recession in the UK hits its peak and not long before our own of that era. Fast forward to today, their latest album Black Ice tops the charts in the UK. And the economy? Well, you know what's going on there. Back in Black indeed. What about Back in Red? And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Monday. Today, the Dow fell 203 points, 2.4%. The NASDAQ dropped 46 points, 2.9%. The S&P 500 lost 27 points, 3.1%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Our special coverage of the financial crisis continues tomorrow early on the Marketplace Morning Report. And next time on this program, why fairies are in and princesses are totally out.
Like Snow White, like she wasn't as smart. You don't take food from strangers.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.